Our next case is State v. Williams. Again, this is State v. Williams. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Colleen Ashley. I'm with Arca County Public Defender's Office, hearing on behalf of the appellant Barbara Williams. At this time, I would ask for 1 minute. Your Honor, there are two issues I'd like to address today. The first, the trial court decision to overrule the appellant's clean bar. The second, the trial court's decision to deny the appellant's motion for relief. Here we have a case where there was prosecutorial misconduct that was intended to promote the appellant to move for a mistrial. What it really boils down to is the prosecution's intent. We can use State v. Muhammad, those factors provided, to decipher the prosecution's intent. But ultimately, the actions in this case by the prosecution speak louder than their words. I urge the court to look at the prosecution's actions. Between May 11th, the time that new evidence was discovered, until May 13th, the day the new evidence was disclosed.
But if in fact, which I think is what the Lord court found, the prosecution possibly had rebuttal evidence, and therefore there was no duty to disclose rebuttal evidence, where is the bad faith in that?
With that comes the state waiting for appellant to open the door so that they can introduce that evidence on rebuttal. While they're waiting for that to happen, there is inaccurate evidence that the jury, the court, defense counsel is all operating on. Unfortunately for the prosecution, the appellant did not open the door. And it wasn't until appellant inquired into the prosecution's rebuttal witnesses that the nature of the testimony and the new evidence was actually disclosed. Had that disclosure been made earlier, appellant could have sought remedy under 29-19-19, but by that point, it was too late.
There's no question there was a violation of 29-1918, which imposes a duty to disclose promptly newly discovered material. But in terms of showing prosecutorial intent, intent is always a difficult issue no matter the case. But the district court talked about in its order, as I recall, that what would be the point for the state in this case to have wanted a mistrial when the evidence was favorable to it, and in fact, this new material evidence that was disclosed late would have favored their case. So to want to have to go through and run the risk of a mistrial would be inconsistent with what was going on with them at trial. So that does favor that it wasn't their intent.
On the flip side, Your Honor, a second trial would have been much more favorable to the prosecution. Their theory of guilt almost entirely rested upon the witness testimony. And they could not reconcile the witness's deposition and trial testimony with the timing on the cell phone record.
Didn't the new timing that was discovered later, wasn't that going to make your client's defense more difficult?
Correct. With the second trial, the prosecution could have introduced this new evidence, and it would have been an opportunity for their witnesses to regain credibility.
Could we talk about the other motion that was filed for attorney fees and extra fees and so forth? The court, is, from what I could tell, basically decided not to award any of those requested fees because it determined that it wasn't the intent to provoke a mistrial. Is that the right standard for determining penalties for violating disclosure statute?
I would argue that the finding on the first issue, the clean bar, should not preclude the court from being able to order a motion for other relief because it's a different standard of review. The motion for other relief was abuse of discretion. And it was within the trial court's discretion to order that the charges against appellant be dismissed with prejudice and to impose a financial sanction. It chose not to, I think, based on its finding on the clean bar, but I would argue that it's not the standard.
But if the lower court found After hearing all of the evidence and observing the witnesses, that it was not a bad faith move on the part of the prosecution, that they did think they were dealing with rebuttal evidence. So therefore, there shouldn't be any penalties for that, even though it may have caused some economic harm. If they, in fact, in a good faith belief, felt they were dealing with rebuttal evidence that would not have to be disclosed, there wouldn't be a reason to award financial sanctions.
It could award financial sanctions.
And then that's the discretion of the court, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But is it your position the court focused on the plea and bar as kind of dictating what it could or could not do, and that was the discretion of the court to do that?
Correct. That is the way I read the trial court's order.
That should have evaluated the emotion from Ms. Lane's speech for violating the statute and promptly disclosed it. That's a different review than whether or not the plea and bar is successful.
Yes,
do you have any case law to support your position?
Well, the position, I would argue State v. Kula, where the Supreme Court says the discovery process is not a game of hide the ball, and discusses that the court has broad latitude in deciding what to do as a consequence of a discovery violation. Unfortunately, I don't have any other cases to tie to offhand right now, Your Honor.
Is there a difference between something that's, you know, discovered during this discovery pretrial stage, let's say 6 months in advance of trial, as opposed to something that's discovered on the second day of a five-day trial?
I think there is a big difference. I know that according to the law, it can be disclosed during trial, and the appellant has options under 29-19-19 to seek a remedy. But the difference is that those remedies here weren't available since it was so late in the game. The appellant had presented her entire defense. All the witnesses had been examined, but potentially one, the appellant. She had called her expert witness, and there was no turning back at that point. So I think the distinction is that the timing in this case left the appellant no other option.
But you got your mistrial.
She did get her mistrial, which the prosecution did not object to the appellant's motion for mistrial, which I think...
And that's one of the factors, right?
It is, whether they resisted the motion for mistrial. And they did not object to the motion for mistrial, but then in their affidavit state that they did not intend to provoke the appellant to move for a mistrial, nor did they want a mistrial. But if they did not want a mistrial, then they should have objected to the appellant's motion.
Well, that's kind of a catch-22 then, isn't it? Because if you do one or the other, it can be used as a factor against factor in the analysis.
True, but I think to corroborate their statements in the affidavit, we have to look at their actions. And the two didn't match.
Did the district court refer to this, or was it somewhere in the record? It's coming to mind that there was an off-the-record meeting to discuss possible mistrial. So we don't have that in a record before us. And so I thought maybe the trial judge referred to that as a basis for why there was no objection.
That's correct, Your Honor. The court did note that an off-the-record discussion in chambers occurred, which may have muted the state's stance on the mistrial. But since we are confined to the record, all we have to go on is the fact that they did not object on the record. With that, Your Honor, if there are no questions at this time, the appellant respectfully requests this court reverse the lower court's decision overruling the appellant's claim and bar and denying the appellant's motion for other relief.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
May it please the court, I'm Sarah Marquezzi, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. The order from which Williams appeals addresses two issues, the plea and bar and the motion for appeal. Beginning with the plea and bar, the narrow issue before this court is whether the district court was clearly wrong finding that the prosecution did not intend to revoke the mistrial. This is a question of fact. In the controlling Nebraska Supreme Court case, State versus Muhammad, the court held that the trial court is in a better position than a reviewing court to judge the motives and intentions of the prosecutor. Under Muhammad, absent the intention to goad the defendant into moving for mistrial, even grossly negligent or deliberate misconduct, which was not present here, will not support the district court in sustaining a plea and bar. The record supports the district court's finding here that the state did not intend on both mistrial. The district court carefully considered relevant factors as the facts of the case in the 8-page order. Both prosecutors submitted affidavits explaining that they did not intend to provoke a mistrial. During trial, prosecutors realized the defense was misinterpreting its own evidence by assuming that cell phone records were recorded in central time zone, even though the records did not contain any time zone information at all. The state sought clarification from Sprint. After the third day of trial, they finally received from Sprint a tangible document showing that some of the calls have been reported in mountain time.
But there was some verbal communication on the second day of trial that would have put them on notice that may be a problem.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And the reason that I focus on the tangible document that they received from Sprint is because the district court's order referenced violations of 29.19.12, the discovery statute. And looking at that statute, the only provision that I see that could encompass the Sprint information is Section 1F, which references documents, books, accounts, letters, photographs, objects, or other tangible things. So the point at which the state had a tangible thing, which it knew it could be used as evidence, that it did not immediately disclose, was the evening after the day of trial. And then it did disclose that information the next day, but after the after one witness, so it didn't disclose it immediately on Friday morning.
Hello, can you address the other motion under 1919? As I was discussing with Ms. Gassett, it appears that the district court seemed to tie the two motions together, that since it ruled adversely on the pre and bar, it therefore sort of dismissed even evaluating the requests under the 1919 motion.
Your Honor, my reading of the trial court's order, which was pages 61 through 68 of the record, is not so much that it was applying the same standard, but that it was same based on the same considerations. It had very carefully gone through the evidence, the facts of the case, its findings on intentions. And so I think that the same factors that led it to believe that the state acted honorably was not intending to provoke a mistrial, but believed that they had strong rebuttal evidence. Those factors informed the court's decision that within its discretion, it did not believe that discovery sanctions aside from the mistrial were appropriate.
And again, our review of that is we review the current abuse of discretion.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court is afforded broad discretion with respect to the sanctions, including involving discovery procedures. And there's good reason for that. In this case, both parties bear some responsibility for the situation that culminated in the mistrial here. Granted, the state, the district court found that the state should have disclosed the Sprint evidence sooner. However, the defense brought some of this harm upon itself by not thoroughly investigating its own key evidence. In its motion for relief, on page 49 of the transcript, the defendant states that the time zone evidence would have caused it to reform its opening statement and substantially change how it cross-examined witnesses.
And some of it was their evidence, correct?
Yes, this was the defense's evidence. So the defense introduced this evidence, mentioned it in opening statements, and cross-examined the parents before the state did any investigation whatsoever. The state did nothing to force errors with the earlier use of this evidence and could have done nothing to correct them at that point in time.
But arguably, when the state learned of the evidence on day two, and I realize we're waiting for the written confirmation, The 2918 says prior or during trial, the party discovers additional material, et cetera, et cetera. There's a duty to disclose and they shall promptly notify the other party in the court of the existence of that material. So there was a violation. So the court could then impose sanctions. And I understand. It's very discretionary whether they impose it or not. But my concern is a little bit that the court didn't evaluate the request separately in terms of what does this mean, you know, the fact that several days of trial went on, but maybe shouldn't have gone on, by simply saying, well, I denied the plea in power, so therefore I'm not going to warn any attorney, you know, give any other plea.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, reading the court statements and the record in its order, I believe that it did take both of these issues very seriously and consider the options available to it. And the court's not under an obligation to enter a written order explaining why it does not impose discovery sanctions. In State v. Schmidt, quoted in our brief, this court has said that within the court's discretion is the option to enter no order at all on discovery sanctions. So I don't believe that the order here, which was very careful, was an abrogation of the court's duty to consider this seriously.
Is it a violation of that statute if the attorney in good faith believes that what he or she is dealing with is rebuttal evidence, and therefore there is no duty to disclose it?
Well, the district court found that it was in this case.
I'm talking about the attorney himself or herself. Yep. Isn't that part of the trial strategy sometimes, that you come upon something and if you truly believe in good faith that you're dealing with rebuttal evidence and there's no duty to disclose, then that wouldn't be a violation of that statute, right?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. I believe there is an argument here that perhaps they did not violate the statute because they didn't receive the tangible evidence until the evening before they did disclose it. I couldn't find any case law on what promptly means in 1918. Their intent surely is relevant to the district court's discretionary decision not to impose sanctions, because it's an important factor. They weren't trying to cause harm to the defense. And in some ways, the mistrial saves the defense from itself. If, for instance, they had immediately disclosed the information, some harm had maybe been done, perhaps this information came in as rebuttal evidence, that could have been very damaging to the defendant. And so I believe that the district court was within its discretion to do precisely what it did here, award the mistrial, deny the plea and bar, and deny further sanctions. And as the Nebraska Supreme Court has held in State v. Newman, the law has never looked upon the declaration of a mistrial as a mild slap upon the wrist. Mistrial is a rigorous means for addressing even grossly negligent or deliberate misconduct. Those weren't present here. On the facts of this case, the district court did not use its discretion. And for these reasons, the state asks this court to affirm the order of the district court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How much time is this? 38 seconds. Your Honor, just to be clear, appellant did not want to trial. She was forced into it. Specifically, the motion for other relief, I think it deserves careful consideration, and we don't know that the court gave it the consideration it deserves. The failure to promptly disclose evidence does not contain a good faith requirement. If they're clearly a violation, they fail to promptly disclose the evidence, and I think that has to be considered by the court.
But you do agree that the rebuttal evidence is not as far as being disclosed?
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah. In this case, though, waiting for the appellant to open the door had some serious ramifications because this inaccurate information seeped into the trial, the jury, the defense counsel, the judge. Everybody was operating on this inaccurate information, which could have easily been corrected by the prosecution at any moment between those 2.5 days.
Thank you very much. The matter is submitted. Thank you both.